years. I started at UC Berkeley. Were you still an undergrad when you got the little job for
the collision problem?
Yeah.
No.
You just started your master's?
No, it was the US.
Yeah, you don't have a master's. Yeah. Anyway, started his career by proving a 5-year-old open problem that quite a number of us have been working on or trying to work on. The collision problem. There's been a variety of work in quantum algorithms, in particular complexity theory, and also work on the foundations of quantum information and physics as well. And this is sort of related, I guess, to the topic of this talk today, the learnability of quantum states.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. So, yeah, I gave this talk 5 days ago at the university, but I'm making the rounds of the entire Kitchener-Waterloo area. So, and this one is special for sure for physicists. So, okay, so the basic problem I'm interested in is called quantum state tomography. And the problem is, well, suppose that we have some physical process which produces as many copies as we like of some quantum state row. We don't know what the state is. But now to each copy, we can apply some measurement. So each copy, we can apply some two outcome measurement. I'll think it's the most general kind of measurement, a P of M, A. And such a measurement will yield an outcome 1 with probability trace of E times rho when applied to the state rho, and 0, outcome 0 with probability 1 minus the trace of E times rho. Okay. So now the goal is to learn an approximate description of the state by putting together all the different measurement outcomes. We want to find out what state we're dealing with. Okay, and interesting, experimentalists actually do this. I dug up a bunch of papers. There's hundreds of them, but what are some of the things people have done? They've used tomography to learn about, to get a detailed picture of a chemical reaction, the dissociation of iodine molecules, to sort of test and characterize quantum equipment and like quantum gates or CNOT gates in order to try to study decoherence mechanisms. In order to demonstrate preparation of certain states. So this is really sort of a new kind of problem for me, because most of the work I've done, sort of, even if 30,000 years from now people have quantum computers, right, it would still be pretty useless. Okay. This is something that, this is not a hypothetical problem. This is something people actually do now. I think that I'll be able to tell experimentalists how they should be doing it better. So what's the problem? Well, there's sort of a fundamental problem with quantum state tomography, and this is just that to do tomography on an entangled state of n qubits, you in general need 4 to the n measurements. You need an exponential number of measurements. Certainly, you need at least 1 measurement for every independent parameter in a 2 to the n by 2 to the n density matrix. All right, so this is a huge number of parameters that you have to learn. And what really concerns me is this exponential scaling. Okay, this is a real experimentalists are very well aware of this, and they write about this as a problem. And until recently, the world record of the largest state anyone had done tomography on was 4 qubits. Okay? And then recently, in some heroic effort, there was a paper in Nature from a year ago, Hafner et al. Managed to do tomography, or decent tomography, I guess, of some 8-qubit state. And for that, they had to do 656,000 experiments. Okay. So, you can imagine, what about for 9 qubits, right, 10 qubits, right? I mean, and this is not just steps of a computer. This is, for some lab equipment. So this is, this is really steps. Okay. So the question I would ask is, does this mean that sort of a generic quantum state of, say, 10,000 particles, can never be learned, we mean by that, within the lifetime of the universe? That's certainly a practical problem for the for the experimenters, but to me it's also a conceptual problem. Okay, so let me try to explain why. Well, I mean, it really goes back to this question of, well, what is a quantum state? You know, and I realize that this is not a question that really, you know, occurs to anyone here at Perimeter Institute, but, you know, let me try to get you to think about it anyway, okay? So, all right, well, you know, people like to argue about, no, what is a quantum state? Is it an objective state that's out there in the world? Or, you know, is it just a representation of our knowledge of a physical system? So, well, I don't know. You can duke that one out. But, so what I would say is, well, whatever else a quantum state might be, sort of at the least, you know, one would think that it ought to be a useful hypothesis, something that encapsulates our previous observations of a physical system and thereby allows us to predict future observations. And you might say, well, okay, but, you know, everyone agrees that the quantum state does that, right? We know that they do that. But, the problem is, well, what about when we scale up to very, very large states? I mean, so how useful, how predictive sort of is a hypothesis about the state of some system that takes, you know, 10 to the 5,000 bits or something even to write down? Okay, so, you know, as could happen, say, for some generic state of, you know, some large number of entangled particles. If this is true that the size of a quantum state, you know, in some sense as a hypothesis, increases exponentially with the number of qubits, I mean, you know, it would seem to bolster the arguments of quantum computing skeptics. You know, I've given some examples. So, you know, Odette Galbraith, you know, Leonid Levin, a computer scientist, and then physicists, you know, Gerard Hooft, Wolfram, Roger Penrose. These are a more questionable case, can be, you know, goes back and forth. But people, you know, who have proposed, or in some cases, who know with certainty that quantum mechanics is going to break down in the limit of a large number of particles. So the physicists, you know, sort of have their own reasons for thinking that quantum mechanics could break down, you know, but the computer scientists who believe this, they, you know, really come out and say explicitly it's just not reasonable to have a description of a physical system whose size or whose complexity increases exponentially with the size of the system that you're trying to describe. And so can we sort of get to the root of what's worrying them about that?
That's kind of a worst case complexity.
Right? Yes.
I mean, why would you expect that an average case or an interesting case state would take that much
space? That's a very good point. So this is certainly one way out that we could take. We could say, well, you know, this is what's true in the worst case, but, you know, the physical systems that we're really going to care about, they're going to have some symmetry or some translational invariance. They're going to be easier to characterize. So this is one direction we could go. You know, if we take that direction, then we're basically saying, you know, in general, you know, quantum states are sort of, you know, seem like inherently unreasonable, but there's some small subset of them that's more reasonable. Right, and then the next question we would have to ask is, what is that subset? Can we characterize it? Right, what's the property that separates that from the other states? You know, and I mean, I've thought about this question. It's actually very hard to come up with some sort of separating criterion of that sort. So what I'm going to try to argue is that we don't have to take that layout. There's another layout. Thanks. I think, you know, really, at bottom, what we're talking about is sort of David Hume's problem of induction. Which is one of the most famous problems in philosophy. But okay, what is, you know, basically it's, you have, say, 500 ravens, you know, there's only 9 there, you can imagine, 491 more. And, you know, every one of, let's say, every single one that you see is black. And, so we know that it's logically possible that the next raven you see could be white, but that's not the question. The question is, why does this give you any grounds whatsoever for even expecting the next raven that you see to be black, right? Why isn't that just a completely independent fact about the world, the color of the 501st raven that you see? So there's David Hume, you know, puzzled over this. So, a lot of people have heard of this problem. What I think is not much appreciated is that in the past few decades, computer science has been able to say a lot about this question. Arguably has been able to sort of more or less answer it insofar as it has an answer. So in particular, there's a field called computational learning theory, which takes this very sort of question as its starting point. And the short answer, the basic answer is that when in practice, there could be 2 to the 500, hypotheses about the colors of 500 ravens, but we never consider all of those hypotheses. We always only consider a small subset, of the possible hypotheses, a hypothesis class, which is vastly smaller than the class of all logically conceivable hypotheses. So the question isn't really, how is induction possible? The question is more, what properties does our class of hypotheses have to satisfy for induction to be possible? So there's a framework for studying this question, and it's called probably approximately correct learning, PAC learning. So I can, to give you the basics of this framework, basically, so you have some set S, which is called your sample space. And then you have a probability distribution D over S, which doesn't have to be known in advance. It's just sort of a distribution over which examples you could see. And now we have a class of hypotheses that we'll consider, which for now I'll just imagine them to be Boolean functions that map each element of our sample space to yes or no. They classify it as a yes instance or a no instance. Okay, and now we have some unknown function F, which is sort of the true hypothesis out there that describes the universe. It's the true theory that we want to find. And now we're given some experimental data. Okay, what's that? Well, we're given samples, x1 to xm, which are drawn independently from the sample, sample distribution. And then for each of them, we're told its classification. We're told, for each xi, we're told f of xi. Okay, and given this data, we want to generalize. So we want to output a hypothesis that will agree not only with the data we've seen, but with most of the data that we haven't seen. Okay, so the probability over points that are drawn from the sample distribution that the hypothesis is equal to the true function should be greater than or equal to 1 over epsilon. Okay, we know that we can't, get it perfectly right, or we're not hoping for that. And furthermore, we know that if our data happens to be really crummy, then we're not going to be able to even get it approximately. So we say we only want this with high probability over the choice of samples. Okay, so this is why it's probably and approximately. And the one point I guess that's important here is that the distribution on which we're being tested is the same distribution as the one from which the samples are drawn. Right, so you can express the same sort of nothing should be on the test that wasn't covered in class, basically. Right. I mean, if you're, it's sort of clear that it's hopeless if you're, if you're going to be tested on some completely different distribution than the one from which you've already seen examples. Okay, so now there's a theorem, sometimes called the Occam's razor theorem. That's William of Occam, I believe is a Gillette. So the simplest, way to state this theorem was the simplest version of it. It's the one that was proved by Leslie Valiant in 1984. So he says, okay, in the special case that our class C of possible hypotheses is finite, then all we have to do is take this amount of sample data, amount of sample data which is proportional to 1 over epsilon times the log of the number of possible hypotheses divided by delta. Okay, so we have to, find a hypothesis which is compatible with that number of points, with that number of random samples, and if we do that, then with probability at least 1 minus delta over the choice of samples, that hypothesis will be compatible with at least a 1 minus epsilon fraction of future data. So the key point is that, there could be exponentially many hypotheses, and because we're taking the log, this is still reasonable. This is a polynomial number of samples that we have to look at. So, So one way, you know, to think of this, if we think through what if we're saying philosophically, if we're saying compression implies prediction. Okay, so you know, if we want to sort of predict future data, then you know, one way to do that, which is sufficient, sort of, is to find a representation or an encoding of our past data that takes fewer bits to describe than the past data itself, right? And you know, actually, you can prove a sort of converse to this, that whenever you're able to predict the future, and in some sense, you know, it must be because you're able to output some compressed representation of the data that you've already seen. And you know, I think that you know this sort of intuitively makes sense, right? So, I mean, for example, you know, it's like a hypothetical example. You know, you could imagine that, so you know, you had some theory in physics, and no matter what data was going to be found in some particle accelerator, you could cook up some, you know, I don't know, some way to curl up some extra dimensions or something that would explain it, right? And so you know, if this is the case, then clearly, you know, we're probably not going to expect that our theory is going to predict the next, you know, data element that would be found, right? Because you know we were just able to fit it to whatever data we had. Whereas if our you know if our number of parameters is a lot smaller than the hypothesis you know than the data that we've already seen, then we will expect it to generalize, right? And but the nice thing is that within this framework of pack learning, you can actually state this Occam's razor principle, you know, as a theorem, and you can prove it, and then you can work out exactly what the quantitative trade-offs are.
What's the theorem rely on?
Huh? Oh, so this theorem is the simple form I've stated here is just completely like three-line proof. It's the sort of the union bound that you know you can consider each possible hypothesis. And then, if it didn't, you know, if it disagreed with the 1 minus epsilon fraction of the data, then sort of it would have been killed off already by the example you've already seen, right? And so, therefore, if you pick a hypothesis that's not killed off, then because there was only a small number of hypotheses to begin with, then we can just use the union bound and say probably that, you know, that hypothesis will work. So this version is very easy. Now there's more sophisticated versions of this theorem, which is actually what I'm going to have to draw on, which are much more difficult to prove and which you know take some more combinatorics. So, yeah.
But you assume random samplings, right? So how do you know
yeah.
random sampling?
Yeah. So you're making some assumption, which is either you know random sampling, you know, or you know there's some sort of time invariance, right? You have to assume. In some sense, that the future is going to resemble the past. Otherwise, you know, it's just clear a priori that learning is not going to be possible, right? But you know, the nice thing is that you know, given your class of hypotheses, you can then quantify exactly you know how much data you're going to need. But yeah, as I said before, you need some assumption about the class of hypotheses. You know, which we always implicitly have in practice, even if we're not thinking about it. Okay. All right. Well, but so we can try to apply this to quantum states, and we run into two immediate problems. Well, the first one is that you know the number of possible quantum states is not finite. There's a 2^0 of them, right? So this theorem doesn't apply. Well, so. You know, well, of course, you know, we can discretize the quantum states. You know, we only really care about getting an approximate answer anyway. But even if we do that, there's the number of quantum states, you know, any pair of which are far from each other is still doubly exponential in the number of qubits, right? It's, you know, it's not singly exponential. Okay, and so, you know, if we take the log, then, you know, there's still an exponential amount of data that we would need to make predictions. So this doesn't look good. Okay, but it turns out that you can deal with this. You can, you know, using some more sophisticated learning theory results, you can solve these problems. Okay, so my main result is a quantum Occam's razor theorem. Okay, so I can go through what it says. So consider an n-qubit quantum state rho. And then what did this sample distribution do? Be a distribution over possible two outcome measurements that we might apply. Okay, and now, so we suppose that we draw M measurements, the E1 up to EM, independently from this distribution. And suppose that we then output a hypothesis state, sigma, which approximately agrees with the true state, rho, on those measurements. So for each of the measurements, E sub I, that we've seen, the probability that, you know, E sub I accepts the state rho is close to the probability that E sub I accepts sigma. Okay, they're within some parameter eta of each other. Okay. And I'll assume that that parameter is sufficiently small. So, okay, and then I'll assume that that we've seen a sufficiently large number of samples. So I'll assume that, you know, we've number M of samples that we've seen, well, should be at least this. Okay. You don't really have to worry about all of these factors here. You know, in any case, I can play around with them and I can improve them, you know, if you're willing to trade off, you know, the other ones. But the main thing to notice here is that the number of samples you need increases only linearly with the number of qubits. It's proportional to n. Okay. It's not exponential in n. It's not even n squared or anything. Okay, it's just linear in the number of qubits. And furthermore, it's polynomial in the inverses of the error parameters. Okay. So provided that you have that number of samples, what I can say is that then your hypothesis quantum state sigma will generalize. Okay. So with high probability over the choice of sample measurements you saw, then state sigma will approximately predict the outcomes of most further measurements that you might make on the state. So yes.
How are you getting the hypothesis state?
Ah, so that's an excellent question. This theorem doesn't say anything about that. I'm going to talk about that later, but you know, this is basically the next problem to consider. So you can in classical learning theory, I should point out the same problem arises, right? That these classical learning results just say, well, if you find a hypothesis that agrees with the current data, then the hypothesis will predict future data. But actually, finding the hypothesis could be a computationally intractable problem. And in fact, we have evidence, you know, that it has to be an intractable problem in some cases. But there are other special cases of the learning problem where we can give very non-trivial efficient algorithms for finding the hypothesis. So then we can say, not only do you have this information theoretic result, but you can also find the hypothesis with a reasonable amount of computation. Okay, so, you know, I believe there should be similar results in the quantum case, and this is a wide open area. There's a whole theory that's sort of waiting to be, you know, made by someone here. So, I will say it's the computational situation is not as bad as what the experimentalists were doing before. I'll say about that later. But yeah.
So would this mean that, like, for all hypothesis states that agree?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a stronger result. And I think it's not just saying that there's a way to find such a state, but saying any state that agrees with the data you've already seen is going to agree with most of the future data also. And, you know, these are the different parameters. So, okay, so... you know, I mean, it's once you have the idea, it's not so, you know, a hard thing to prove based on, you know, putting together things that people already knew. But when I talked to experimentalists, they sort of did not, you know, they hadn't sort of considered that, you know, it might be possible to do anything useful with a linear number of measurements. So it might be useful to give some examples for intuition, right? So. First, you know, let's suppose that your distribution over measurements is uniformly random, so it's just the Haar measure. In that case, you know, you can sort of show that just the maximally mixed state will work perfectly well as an explanatory hypothesis, right? For a random measurement, pretty much any state looks like the maximally mixed state, right? So just you're throwing away your your information. I mean, you know, and you know, so you could say, oh, but you know, the maximally mixed state is very far from, you know, the true state, and some, you know, the usual metrics like trace distance, right? And that's true. But you're only gonna, you know, if say the state that you're trying to find is some pure state pointing off in some, you know, unknown direction. But the point is, you know, it's going to, you know, in order to find the basis that distinguishes the two, or find a basis that's sensitive to the difference, you know, could take you billions of years, right? So we're just, you know, interested in sort of explaining, predicting the outcomes of the future measurements that you're actually going to make. Okay. So, all right, another example would be, you know, if the distribution were concentrated on, say, 1 and 2 qubit measurements, then you're not going to see training data that's going to tell you much about sort of, you know, measurements involving 3 or more qubits, right, or sort of many particle entanglement. But then again, you're not going to need that data either, right, because, you know, you're not going to be tested on it. So, you know, I guess so, when you think about some concrete examples, then yeah, it's plausible that, you know, you could get by with just a linear number of measurements. So I guess the more surprising thing is that this is true in general. This is true for any state, for any distribution over measurements. Okay, so yeah, so this was a question, how do we actually find the state sigma? Well, I can give you one way to do it. Yeah, I should make more room. Okay. All right. So how do we actually find the state? One way you could do it is just let, say, B1 up to Bn be the binary outcomes of measurements E1 up to Em. So, you know, each one is 0 or 1. And then choose a hypothesis state sigma to minimize the sum of the squares of the differences between these sort of these measurement outcomes and the predicted outcomes for your hypothesis state. All right, this is probably the learning algorithm that I would recommend. So one nice thing about it is, you know, right, so this computational complexity question is, it's clear that, you know, this is going to take time exponential in the number of qubits, right? I mean, even just to write down the output, you know, is takes exponential time, but it's a convex programming problem, which means that at least the time is only singly exponential in it. Right? You can solve, you know, if you think in terms of the Hilbert space dimension, then you can solve the sort of convex programming problem in time, which is polynomial in the dimension of the Hilbert space. And, you know, in practice, computation has not been the limiting factor in tomography. It's been, you know, just doing the actual experiments. So at least this is my understanding. You know, I don't do them myself, but I'm told that, you know, they're pretty laborious. So so I think this, you know, this definitely extends the range where you can do something meaningful. This probably, you know, certainly should push it up to, you know, at least was like 15 qubits, and, you know, probably the more. You know, just, you know, how much classical computer power do you want to use, right? So. Okay, so there, you know, there has been sort of previous work on sort of doing pretty good quantum state tomography, sort of, you know, trying to estimate a quantum state when you haven't made a complete set of measurements or anything close to one. So, you know, Buzek et al. Has some papers about it, and there's other people who've studied this. And almost all of these papers, the algorithm that they use is something like this. It's, you start out by assuming some uniform, say, prior probability distribution over possible pure states. Okay, and then you perform some measurements, and then you update your prior using Bayes' rule, right, or maybe using maximum likelihood. So this is not just the maximally mixed state. Really, you know, you just have a probability distribution over pure states, but you just think of as pure states, right? So it's different. And almost all of them sort of, you know, take this Bayesian type approach. Though, well, so what are the disadvantages of it? First of all, the computational complexity is just staggering. As far as I can tell, it's doubly exponential in the number of qubits. reviewing the maintain this, you know, enormous distribution. Also, to find the, you know, the most likely state seems to be an NPR problem. Okay, and then the other thing is that, you know, why are we starting with a uniform prior over states? You know, I mean, if you're, you know, really like a Bayesian fundamentalist, then, you know, you have a prior for everything. Well, okay, but, you know, we don't really have a lot of, you know, advanced control over what the state is. So the difference in this learning-based approach is you don't need to make any assumption about a distribution over states. Hey, you can, you know, it works for any state. You can make a worst-case assumption about the states, that the state is chosen by an adversary who's trying to screw you up. You know, all you need is a prior distribution over which measurements you're going to be interested in. Right, and you know, this seems to me to be advantageous because you do have control over which measurements you're interested in. Right, that's something you have more control over than what the state is that you're trying to learn. Okay, all right. So I'll say a little bit about how you prove the theorem. So we use a notion which was introduced by Kearns and Shapir, which is called the fat shattering dimension. Okay, so. This is it's a way of measuring the dimensionality or complexity of a class of functions. In this case, they're going to be real value functions. So let's C be a class of functions which maps our sample space S to the unit interval 0, comma 1, you know, the probabilities. And now, given some subset of the sample space, given a set x1 up to xk in S, we say that set is gamma shattered by our class of hypotheses, if there exist real numbers, say a1 up to ak, such that, there's a lot of quantifiers, okay, such that for all 2 to the k possible statements of the form, well, f of x1 should be less, should be at most a1 minus gamma, f of x2 should be at least a2 plus gamma, and so forth. For any kind of, you know, 2 to the k sort of, you know, sets of requirements of that form, we can find some function in our hypothesis class that meets those requirements. Okay? If our subset x1 to xk has that property, then we say it's gamma shattered by the hypothesis class. So this is just an example that we can ask, you know, it's basically that sort of just knowing that our function is in this hypothesis class sort of, you know, tells us really nothing about how it's going to behave, you know, with respect to these inputs, whether it's going to be, you know, we could know sort of its values on k minus one of these variables. We still know nothing about its value on the k of one, right? At least in terms of whether it's less than or greater than this some one particular value. And the reason it's called fat shattering dimension is that there's this fatness here, right? So we're not just asking that it should be less than or more than this value, but it should be, you know, it should be at least gamma less than it, or at least gamma more than it. Okay, so now we'll define the dimension of the class, the gamma fat shattering dimension of our class of functions. That's just the size of the largest set, which is gamma shattered by the class. And this turns out, you know, it's not, you know, it's not quite obvious for people to come up with this. This turns out to sort of be the right measure of complexity of a class of real value functions for trying to prove things. So there's basically just two pieces to the proof of the theorem. The first piece is to say that if a class of functions has small fat shattering dimension, then it's learnable with a small number of samples. Okay. So this is the basic, you know, this is one of, you know, several similar theorems that I can prove. So basically we say, well, let C be a class of functions from S to the unit interval, and let F be a function in that class. Now suppose that we draw M elements x1 to xm independently from the distribution D. And then we output a hypothesis H, which approximately agrees with the true function f on each of those data points. Okay, then provided that you know, we've agreed sufficiently well, and provided that we've taken enough samples, the number of samples you notice is, you know, proportional, just linear in the fat shattering dimension, then this hypothesis will probably approximately predict most of the future data. So this is sort of a real valued analog of Valiant's result. And for, you know, luckily for me, most of the work in proving this had been done by other people. So I use like a 96 result of Bartlett and Long, which is builds on sort of a, there was this breakthrough result of a Long et al, you know, that it was an open problem, whether you could prove such a thing, and they did, and building on this Bloomer et al, who generalized valiance result. So, you know, so it's you know, it's some, you know, machinery and, you know, computer science and statistics, I guess, if it goes into this, you know, really, you know, most of it has been, you know, fortunately for me, it's been done.
Why do you use the
letter omega? Oh, I'm sorry. This is just the computer science notation. That means that M should be at least proportional to that. It should be at least a constant times so that.
How is it different than order of?
So order of means it should be at most a constant times that. Yeah, we care a lot about the difference between lower bounds and upper bounds.
So you're picking some function over the class,
yeah.
But your hypothesis also has to be over the class.
Yes, that's true.
So I don't see why you're guaranteed that if I pick one function over the class, that another one might be arbitrarily close to it. And obviously, this will work if h is equal to f, then it's mm-hmm. guaranteed to be zero.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's why
right.
is it necessary that h is in the class?
Why is it necessary that H is in the class here? Why can't you remove that restriction, you're asking? Well, because otherwise we could just pick some arbitrary function that just happens to agree with the data we've seen on and then on the particular data points we've seen, and then on everything else, it's just random, right? And then it's intuitively, it's pretty clear that such a function is not going to predict future data. Right, so we're crucially using the fact that, you know, that there's some constraint, you know, relating past data to the future data, and that constraint is that our hypothesis should be in the class.
But it may equally well be possible that there's nothing in the class that can satisfy that constraint.
So you're saying there certainly will be such a thing, namely F, right?
Besides F. It's not clear there's any other functions.
Right. But you know, we have to do is find some function that agrees. So if f is the only function which is anywhere close to agreeing with it, then we're really in business, because then, you know, we know to take f.
All right. On the other hand, you might miss it.
Yes, so it's gigantic. Well, yeah, so there's the computational problem. So for these results, we're just focusing on the information theoretic problem. And, you know, so like in the classical case, after these information theoretic results, as I said before, were sort of the first step. And after 20 years of research, sort of have gone into the computational problem. And now, you know, the next step would be to consider that in the quantum case. But, yeah. So the second step, you know, we've shown that sort of small fat chattering dimension implies learnability. Well, all right, quantum clearly has to come in somewhere. So this is, you know, we have to show that the quantum states considered as a class of hypotheses have a small fat chattering dimension. For this one, we use a result of Ashwin Nayak. He says is that he was interested in a somewhat different problem, a sort of a coding theory problem. Let's say that you want to encode sort of k classical bits into n qubits in such a way that any bit of your choice can then, you know, it doesn't have to be all of them, just any one bit of your choice can later be recovered with small probability of error, the probability at least 1 minus p. Okay, so now you might think maybe, you know, since quantum states are these exponential objects, maybe you could get an exponentially large savings. You could do this with just, like, you know, you could store this n bit string, which is just like a quantum state of log n qubits, right? But this is not the case. You need a number of qubits, which is just at least the number of classical bits times 1 minus the binary entropy of p. But actually, you get no advantage at all over classical encoding. So proof of this is, you know, ultimately based on Holovitz theorem, sort of a generalization of it. You could say that it's, to me, it's sort of one of the more fundamental consequences, actually, of the linearity of quantum mechanics. The central idea here, not that big of an idea, but sort of to take Nayak's result and turn it on its head. say, well, you know, not, you know, just turn, you know, lemons into lemonade, okay? You know, and Ashwin was saying, well, you know, darn, you know, we only have these, you know, and dimensions to use for coding, and then we say, oh, you know, this is awesome. Now, you know, we only have n dimensions that we have to, you know, worry about for prediction. Okay, so we just take the same result and we just sort of, you know, look at it from a different perspective. So, you know, using Ashwin's result, it's not hard to prove that who let C sub n be the set of functions that map an n qubit measurement E, you know, to trace of E times rho, right, to, you know, the probability, you know, the measurement E accepts the state rho, you know, for some state rho, then this class of functions has gamma fat shattering dimension at most n over gamma squared. So, you know, so for constant gamma, it's just it's linear, right? And you can see that they're sort of saying the same thing. So then, you know, this quantum Occam's razor theorem sort of follows by putting together these pieces. So thanks, Ash. Okay. So I'm just going to sort of give to, a couple of applications of this result, and then I'll finish up. So, okay, so, you know, of course, you know, I don't know if this result's going to be useful for experimentalists. I hope it will be. What I know for sure is that, you know, it's helpful for me, for quantum computing. I can use it to solve some open problems that, you know, that it interested me. So the first application I'll show you has to do with quantum communication complexity, and in particular with simulating quantum one-way protocols by classical one-way protocols. So I took away a lot of the notation here, so I'll just explain it in words. So basically, you know, we have two players, Alice and Bob. Who else? Alice has an n-bit string X, and Bob has an m-bit string Y. Okay, and their goal, you know, together they would like to evaluate some Boolean function f of x comma y, some function of their two inputs. Right? It doesn't have to be defined for all of their inputs, but you know, for the pairs of inputs for which it is defined, they want to evaluate it. And crucial thing, we only allow one-way communication from Alice to Bob. There's no back communication from Bob to Alice. So this is one of the simplest settings of, you know, communication complexity, which is still interesting. So then, you know, the basic theorem that I show is that, so the number of bits that Alice needs to send Bob in a classical probabilistic protocol to enable Bob to evaluate this function f for every input pair is, you know, up to a multiplicative constant. At most, the length of Bob's input times the number of qubits that she needs to send in a quantum protocol. Okay? So what this is saying is that if Bob's input is small, or if they're sort of, you know, if Alice has relatively little uncertainty about, you know, which measurement Bob might want to make, then quantum communication gives you at most a small savings over classical communication. Okay? You know, with the factor being, you know, the length of Bob's input. Okay? So you know, people have been interested for a while in, you know, what's the largest possible gap between classical and quantum communication complexity. And in fact, now just very recently, people have finally managed to prove rigorously, you know, that there are functions where you get an exponential gap between quantum and classical. But in these functions, Bob's input is very large. Bob's input is like the same length as Alice's input, basically. And what this result shows is that this is an unavoidable feature of such functions. Okay. So I should mention that, you know, we had results similar to this before, but like with a logarithmic factor or with an assumption that the function had to be defined for every input pair. So, but this particular theorem we didn't have before. This is a new result, and it really falls out just sort of immediately as a consequence of this quantum Occam's razor theorem. And I can just sort of show you how. So we have a quantum protocol. We want to give a classical simulation of it. right? So what do we do? Well, in the classical protocol, Alice will send Bob sort of some random training examples, okay? So we'll assume that we know like a worst case probability distribution over Bob's inputs, right? And turns out there's this thing, the Minimax theorem, right, which says that if we want to succeed on every input, it suffices to succeed on most inputs drawn from a worst case probability distribution. Okay, so this is known. So Alice, you know, chooses say t inputs from this worst case distribution, possible inputs of Bob, y1 up to yt. And then she sends those inputs over to Bob, along with, for each one, what he ought to output if that were his input, right? So she doesn't know what Bob's input is. Of course, that's the whole problem, because, all right, well, if your input were y sub I, then you should output f of x comma y sub I, right? For each, so she gives them sort of some training examples. So then given those examples, Bob just searches for a quantum message rho that Alice could have sent in the quantum protocol that would have caused, you know, him to produce those outputs, right? That's consistent with those outputs. Okay, and it's clear that at least one such message exists, namely the quantum message that Alice would have sent in the quantum protocol, but you couldn't. So he will find such a message. And then we appeal to the quantum Occam's razor theorem in order to say that as soon as Bob finds such a state, then he knows that it will probably yield the right outputs on most of the other inputs. It will generalize. Okay.
Sorry, but
yeah.
How does he know it'll? This is supposed to be worst case. Why?
This is why I mentioned the Gauss Minimax principle. Yeah. Right. So yeah, I'm implicitly using that here. So we know that to succeed on all inputs, it suffices to succeed on most inputs drawn from a worst case probability, drawn from an adversarially chosen probability distribution. Mm-hmm. This is just comes from the method really is the Minimax theorem.
And in general, it could take them exponential resources to find one,
yep.
But not
yep.
exponential of the exponential.
Right, that's right. So now, right, now in this particular setting, you know, I'm only interested in communication costs, right? So, you know, if we're just interested in communication costs, then we're allowed to ignore computational complexity, right? But, you know, yeah, again, you know, that's the next thing to consider. And I think there has been some work trying to combine communication and computational complexity. So, so now I'll give you a second application for quantum computing. Second application is using trusted classical information, trusted classical data, to verify an untrusted quantum state. Okay, so let me give you an example of this. All right, so you go to the quantum software store, okay, and you buy an n qubit quantum program, psi. Okay, it comes in a very well sealed box. You buy a program that is an n qubit quantum state. You know, you buy this in order to give your quantum computer, you know, to install it on your quantum computer and give it some new functionality, the ability to compute some function that you couldn't otherwise. But you don't trust the software to work as expected. Maybe it's made by NanoSoft Corporation. So you're suspicious of the software. Okay, so you like to verify that the software is going to work. You know, maybe not on all inputs, but at least on most inputs. Okay, so then the theorem I can prove is that there exists a set of benchmark inputs, x1 up to xt, such where t is just a polynomial in n in the size of the program, such that if someone gives you these benchmark inputs and tells you what the appropriate outputs are, and if you then verify that this quantum program psi works on the benchmark inputs, then it's going to work on most of the other inputs as well. Okay? So you can use this trusted classical information to verify that the untrusted quantum state is going to work on most inputs. Okay? And
it may be hard to find what the correct benchmark inputs are, though, right?
Well, in fact, you can say that, you know, for whatever probability distribution over inputs you're considering, if you pick one at random, then it'll work with high probability. Okay, so that does, you know, so it's stronger than this. The hard part is to know what are the right outputs for those benchmark inputs.
Right.
That's really where you have to trust someone to tell you.
Okay.
Yeah, good question. Okay, so what's the intuition for this? Well, it's again this quantum Occam's razor theorem, and you can sort of see this, that, you know, if it agrees, you know, on these test inputs, then, you know, and it's a small enough, you know, state, then with, you know, with high probability, it's going to generalize to most of the other states.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there, I have a feeling I've asked this to you in a separate conversation, but is there an order of quantifiers thing here? So,
yeah.
For a particular psi, there exists a set of benchmark inputs, but is there a set of benchmark inputs that works?
So yeah, you can reverse the quantifiers like that. In fact, yeah, you can.
Okay.
Yeah, so again, so it's stronger than what I've written in several ways, the result. But yeah, it does, you know, the benchmark inputs do have to be tailored to the distribution over inputs that you want to succeed on, which, you know, part of unavoidable. But yeah, okay. So so in sort of using this result, there's one technicality, and this is, well, you know, you want to test psi, verify it on the benchmark inputs, but what if that destroys it? Right, and then your state is no good. And then, all right, so then maybe, you know, you could call up, you know, NanoSoft, you know, the vendor, and they'll give you a new state. Now, how do you know the new state, you know, is good? And you could test that one, and then you destroy that one also, right? So there's a way around this, you know, using the sort of tricks of the trade that, you know, you can first sort of amplify your state to make the error probability small, and then you can do a random number of tests. Right, and you know, and then if it succeeded on this random number of tests, then that, like, with high probability, you could just take that same state and use it on the real input you care about, and with high probability, the same state is going to work. So I proved that in the paper. You know, I won't go through the details. That's sort of the technical part here. Okay.
For the theorem.
Yeah.
The simpler theorem, the state of the
yeah.
Problem, where do the probabilities come in, or do they?
So the probability here was, there were several places probabilities come in, right? But like the delta, you're asking about the 1 minus delta, right? That says with high probability over the choice of benchmark inputs, right? So if someone gives them to you, then you could say, all right, certainly there exists benchmark inputs that will work, so fix those, right? You can also say, pick them at random, then with high probability they'll work.
So there exist ones where the delta...
Yeah,
there'll always be a delta, or will delta go away?
Oh, well, so no, delta will be greater than, delta is always going to be greater than zero if you want to apply this theorem. But, you know, the point is, as long as delta is less than one, there's going to be some, you know, that benchmark inputs that works and you can then fix. And actually, you know, decreasing delta is very, very easy. It goes down exponentially in a number of samples. So, all right, so let's get some open problems. So the first one, this has already come up several times in the talk, but, you know, there's a wide open field. Come up with computationally efficient learning algorithms for special cases of this quantum state learning problem. So, you know, we strongly believe that this is not going to be possible in general, because we believe that it's not possible in general even in the classical case. Maybe this is related to some of the main, you know, open conjectures in, you know, in theoretical computer science. But, you know, what about special cases? What about for stabilizer states? What about for non-interacting fermion states? What about for, you know, different classes of states and, you know, together with classes of measurements on this state where we know that there's some special structure? Can we give a computationally efficient learning algorithm in these cases? All right, well, experimental implementation. That means you, right? All right. This is something, you know, it's really completely feasible to sort of demonstrate with, you know, with current technology. I've talked to a couple of different groups who expressed an interest in it, you know, and I'm hoping that someone will, you know, try this out. You know, I mean, the first step for me will be to actually implement a learning algorithm on a computer, because, you know, to prove the theorem, right, that doesn't mean anything, right, you have to implement. Okay, so, I'll do it. So, it was learning with MATLAB, mathematics. that's one wearing short sleeves, but you know, sort of want to roll them up. So, all right, you know, and you know, I don't know, you know, how much it will be useful for, but basically, you know, anytime you're happy to predict the outcomes of most measurements, you know, this gives you an exponential efficiency improvement in the number of measurements you have to make. So, you know, I expect that it would be useful for something. So. All right, so you know, I showed that I have this bound on measurement complexity, but if we're actually going to be using this in experiments, then one important thing to do would be to tighten this bound. The dependence on the error parameters was pretty bad. I can improve it a little bit at the expense of improving the dependence on the number of qubits from linear to like n log n. But you know, there's some trade-offs there, and then I have lower bounds also on how many measurements you need, but the lower bounds don't quite match the upper bounds. So, you know, this is a question that, you know, computer scientists and learning theory people can take a look at. So further applications to quantum computing. I mean, so, you know, we now have sort of a new tool that we, you know, or a new hammer that we can try to apply to open problems in, you know, about quantum advice, about quantum communication complexity, and so on. It might be useful for some other things. And you know, the results I showed you before, just those results by themselves, you know, we could try to push them further. So this last one was actually suggested to me by Les Valiant, who's a you know computer scientist who introduced the you know classical learning theory, and but, you know, I thought I should throw this out because this is something you know people at Perimeter like to talk about. That you know, could you just take the fact that you know, or the assumption that a quantum state you know has to be learnable with a small number of samples as sort of a basic axiom, and from that, you know, how far can you get in actually deriving you know the structure of quantum mechanics? You know, by taking this as a fundamental axiom. I mean, so, you know, it's not hard to say that, well, if, you know, in various nonlinear versions of quantum mechanics, you know, you really could sort of pack an exponential amount of information into a quantum state, so then the analog of this learning theorem would be false. But, you know, does some, you know, assumption about learnability, you know, in what sense does it sort of, get close to sort of uniquely specifying quantum theory, or you know, if it does at all. So I'll leave you with that. Thanks.
Do you have any more questions?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you actually already mentioned one example where there's a very computationally efficient algorithm, which is when you had a uniform measurement.
Yes.
The best guess is the identity.
Yep.
That's the kind of
Yeah. Well, you didn't have to write that. Well, okay. So do you know if this is also true for other kind of naturally very symmetric measurements, like you know the Pauli matrices?
So if you just did a random Pauli measurement.
Yeah.
Right. That's a very good question. I don't know. I would be happy to think about it with you.
Yeah. So this is discussing this with Robin Blum-Kahada, and he thought that you know for kind of any design or something like that, it could always be.
Wait. Do you mean like a random Clifford group measurement? Is that what you mean, or just a random
untangled? You can do tomography with a random Pauli measurement. Not a random Pauli measurement by making all Pauli measurements.
Yeah. Right.
So you say, what if you make a random one?
Oh, so the Pauli measurements are unentangled, actually, right? These are unentangled measurements, or
well, kind of. I mean, in the sense that the operators are tensor product operators.
Yeah, but all right. But if the
they can detect entanglement, right? I mean,
right.
Because you're to actually perform that measurement, you have.
But you're performing n measurements, right? You're getting n bits of output.
I'm saying that. Okay, yeah. So I guess if you're just making measurements one at a time, they're in that sense. Measurements. So you could group them together and then make entangled measurements.
So when you get n bits of output, then the problem is, you know, if we just consider an arbitrary Boolean function of those n bits, then we can make some hardcore predicate, you know, where the learning problem is going to be hard. Like we could take those n bits as input to a pseudorandom generator or something, but. So, you know, you have to make some assumption, you know, about.
It is a quantum state.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying, you know, these n bits of output, you know, if we can just do some arbitrary computation on them, then, you know, then the n bits of measurement result, then it's going to be hard. Well, we could talk about it later. Okay. So.
This is an indication for NMR, what measurement we can do.
Yeah.
Easily.
So, I mean, in general, like if we say that we're only interested in sort of one qubit measurements, we'll say then it's certainly computationally efficient.
Yeah,
because then we just have to vary each.
I'm shooting multiple qubits.
Right. Yeah.
I noticed you're restricted to two outcome measurements.
Yes.
But is that you mentioned you have all sorts of analogs in this theorem.
After enough physicists asked me about this, I went, I finally sat down for 10 minutes, I generalized the K outcome measurements. So in learning result, I had it was like linear, there's a number of qubits, polynomial on the inverse of the error parameter. So now you also get if you have K outcome measurements, you also get a polynomial in K terms. And the term I get is pretty bad. It's K to some fairly large power. But, if I leave as an open problem, I'm trying to, improve that. Because what I do is I just reduce the K outcome case to outcome case. But if you just looked at the K outcome case directly, I think you could do better.
Okay. And the other question I had was, do you have another one of these analogous Occam's razor theorems for process tomography?
Ah, that's an excellent question. The answer is the analog of this Occam's razor theorem for process tomography is false. If you want to think about why it's false, so the reason is that if you have an unknown quantum process, it really can have sort of exponentially many independent degrees of freedom. Right, even if it's just like if it maps sort of x to x tensor f of x, right, where f is some random Boolean function, then intuitively you're going to have to evaluate, you're going to have to run that process on all 2 to the n inputs x, in order to sort of learn what the process is, right? Or even like if you evaluate it on any subset, you haven't gotten any information about what it's going to do on a new input,
right?
Because they're all independent of each other. You can formalize that with all of those theorem. But so interestingly, this does not work for quantum process tomography. There might be something interesting to say about restricted classes of quantum processes. Yeah.
Like in the classical analog of that question, you're learning a function.
Yeah.
You don't just say you have to learn the whole function, but the distribution on the inputs.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. If you make some assumption, that your class of possible Hamiltonians or unitaries, has some bounded, fat shattering dimension, then you should be able to do something. Okay. So, but the interesting thing for here for learning quantum states, I didn't have to make any assumption about there being a restricted class of quantum states. It's just sort of the structure of Hilbert space by itself already gives me what I need.
But if you had some fixed distribution on the input states, you were going to change this process, and it was just an arbitrary quantum operation.
Yeah.
And it could be feasible, I think, to have some learning relative to that distribution.
No, because there could be 2 to the n inputs, and the function could be random. It could do something really independently random for each of the inputs. So now that if we have a uniform distribution over the inputs, then we will see a polynomial number of inputs for each of those particular inputs. We learn what the output is, but now as soon as we see a new input, we have no idea. We're just guessing.
But how does that work like in the classical case? I'm confused because if you have a function from n bits to 1 bit,
we have to assume a restricted class of functions where you.
So the number of hypotheses.
Yes.
So the number of input has to be small?
If you're not making any assumption about the hypothesis class, then you're basically stuck in a case where, you can predict the data that you've already seen, right? You can retrofit to, things you've already seen, but then you can't generalize and predict, outcomes of experiments you haven't seen. If you want to predict things that you haven't seen, then you need some assumption about the hypothesis class that's going to relate, what you've seen and what you haven't seen.
So in the first theorem of Valiant that you I guess it's due to Valiant, we just took the log of the
That's right.
Now in the case of unitary operations, you can't just take the process tomography, let's say it's unitary, you can't just take the log somehow of
there's a doubly exponential number of quantum processes, right? You take the log, you get an exponential, okay? Now there's also a doubly exponential number of quantum states, right? You take the log, you get exponential, but in the case of quantum states, you can do something better than this. Yeah.
I think this is maybe a stupid question, but I can't resolve that.
Yeah, I think so. No.
So I've never heard the term climbing process telemetry before, but I assume that means you're trying to learn a description of a process, like
yeah.
a completely positive character or not.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So wouldn't that be the same as just trying to learn its choice Minkowski matrix, which is another matrix which is proportional in size to the input and outputs. It seems you're trying to learn a matrix of similar size.
Yeah, so it might be, but it might be a difference in what we mean by learning here, because the difference, I said, the sort of crucial difference between the two is a quantum state, you measure it in some basis and you get, sort of a random output, right? So there's exponentially many amplitudes as long as you don't get to pick which one you see, right? A quantum process, there's, there can be exponentially many different inputs and you get to pick which one you feed in the process. That's the difference.
Yeah. To go back to your last open question.
Yeah.
And there are, in the derivation programs, there is sort of a big open question, which is where the Lino structure comes from. So
the what structure?
The Lino structure.
Right.
Luke, for example, has a CBH derivation and things like this. They start with an algebra. So there are two different things. Which of these are suggesting, all of this is speculative, but anyway. All right, so is your suggestion that learnability could actually be used as a criterion to limit the set of possible algebraic structures to, let's say, algebra, so linear algebra? Or are you saying that this can also be useful within the linear framework for actually finding quantum theory rather than some other stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, this was, I'm just throwing it out because it was, suggested to me by someone else. I don't know how much I believe this, but, I do think that this learnability is certainly one, desidera in the physical theory ought to satisfy, right?
Yeah.
And you could use this as sort of an additional reason, if we needed another reason why quantum mechanics should be linear, right, and not nonlinear.
Yeah.
Now within linear theory, I don't think that it's going to distinguish between, real amplitudes and complex amplitudes.
This sort of resembles Dariano's ideas, Dariano, deriving quantum theory from tomography.
All right. I'm sure I've seen that particular one. I saw some other things by Dariano.
Right.
Thanks again, Scott.